The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to our Tuesday night California time space show program. I am your host, David Livingston, and thank you very much for being with us. We have a terrific first-time guest with us. I've been reading his articles in Aerospace America and elsewhere for a long, long time. Let me make a couple of announcements first, and then we will get into this evening's program. One personal announcement is if any of the listeners out there are associated with or know people at either the Ford Foundation or the Bloomberg Foundations or philanthropy, email me after the show or at some time at drspace@thespaceshow.com. I have a reason for wanting to get in touch with you, and I thank you for that short digression. No Hotel Mars tomorrow. Mr. Bachelor is still getting caught up from his whirlwind trip to Europe and Israel. And next week, no Hotel Mars because I will be in Los Angeles for medical reasons, and we will resume Hotel Mars on May 9th. And our telephone number for tonight is 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners. Be patient, and we'll let the phone ring, and I'll answer it and get you on the air as quickly as possible. Remember, the toll-free number is our preferred way of communicating with our guests with questions and comments, so use it, and we hope you do use it. But you can also use email. It is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com, and you can also post comments on our blog page for tonight's program. I think all of you by now know how to do that. So I'll just leave it at that. If you want to use the blog and you don't know how to do that, send me a short email and I'll whip off some real quick instructions for you. But again, the toll-free number is our preferred method, 1-866-687-7223. I do answer the phone during the break, and I will hold a guest over and skip the break, in fact, if we're on a hot topic with a caller. But otherwise, we definitely want to hear from you. And again, email, which always is great, drspace@thespaceshow.com. While you're at thespaceshow.com, which is our website, a couple of things to point out to you there. In the upper left menu, under support, we have a store with Cafe Press. And if you're interested in T-shirts, hats, coffee mugs, dog clothes, children's clothes, baby clothes, license plate frames, things with the Space Show logo on it, iPhone cases, this is where you will find it. And again, it's in the upper left menu under support. There is also a button in that upper left menu called Listen Live. So this is something you can share with people. It tells you how to listen to live Space Show programs. So I'm always getting emails from people as to how do we listen to a show. So this is how you find that information. So feel free to share it. You'll learn how to listen live to MP3s, which are our archive format off of our website, to our podcasting services, which are also a format of MP3, but they're podcasts. And then for those of you using Alexa by Amazon, the TuneIn player is embedded on our website, and you can use the TuneIn player to listen to the Space Show via Alexa, if that's your thing. So please share that information, and we certainly do appreciate that. I also want to point out the Support the Space Show information, which is center right on our website. So remember, we are a listener-supported program. and we are a 501c3 nonprofit. Our parent is One, O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org. It is the 501c3. So if you donate to us, and we hope you do, and you pay federal taxes, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. If you're a California taxpayer, we're a public benefit corporation over here on the West Coast, and you would also get a tax deduction for your gift against your California taxes. If you have any questions or comments about all of this, visit One, O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org, or simply email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And remember, we would not be doing these programs if it were not for your financial support. So I really appreciate it. Our guests really appreciate it. The listeners do. And please keep it up. And if you have any questions or want any information, you know how to reach me. Email is always the best way, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then do also remember we're trademarked and copyrighted. You do have permission to download and share our programs, although it's easier just to send people the URLs for our programs. There are a couple of rules about that. So one of them is not to do anything commercial with any of our material or our programs. Number two, no edits, clips, cuts, no placing of anything on YouTube or any other website, including your own personal site. If you feel compelled to do so because there's something in a show that you absolutely must use or need to use in something you're doing, email me for permission, and I'll be happy to talk about it with you. You know how to reach me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then finally, the last rule is no written transcripts are permitted at this time, and that includes your personal use. And again, if you have any questions, just email me. You will find our full copyright statement at the bottom of every one of our spaceshow.com website pages, and also at the bottom of every one of the OneGiantLeapFoundation.org website pages. Now, in addition to the individual gifts that we talk about through PayPal, or if you send a check, and all of those instructions are on the website, center right, we do have sponsors, and sponsors have their ads running across the homepage as a banner ad. They get to change it as often as they want, and I read a short message from our sponsors on full-length space show programs, and tonight is a full-length space show program. So I do want to acknowledge the National Space Society. Their ISDC program is coming up. It's really, well, we're about to enter May, so it is really just about a month away because it's in Los Angeles, May 24th to the 27th, and today is April 24th, so yeah, it's a month away. And then also the Space Development Network. This is an online organization that allows you as a space advocate to join together with others to advance the plan for space development, and possibly you will see space settlement occur in your lifetime. They need a wide variety of folks and with interest and skills. The network is free to join. Check it out and make contact with spacedevelopment.org. The Space Symposium, which we're going to talk about in just a minute, just completed their 34th version of the symposium. It is held in Colorado Springs. Their agenda is on the web. I don't yet know which programs are archived and available, but they will be. I've gone through the agenda. It's really impressive. I wish I had been able to go this year. But our guest was there, so in just a minute, we're going to start talking about the Space Symposium. But in the meantime, their website is spacesymposium.org. And then the final sponsor for the first segment is the Integrated Space Plan, the highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming spacefaring. You can see how technologies and destinations build upon one another. You can explore hundreds of individual elements with the interactive plan on the web. And it's at their website, thespaceplan.com. You can buy a copy of the space plan. It's full size. It's color. You can frame it and put it on your wall. It's really impressive. And it is inspiring. And you'll like it. Your family members and your children will like it. So get all of this information over at thespaceplan.com. And so I am very, very happy to welcome for the very first time Tom Risen. And he is a breaking news journalist And he also writes features about space and aviation technology from the Washington, D.C. area. He's a staff reporter for Aerospace America, which you hear me talk about frequently on the show, and we frequently have guests on the show who write in Aerospace America. He has reported also for U.S. News, World Report, Slate, The Atlantic Media, and you should be reading his articles. I mean, they are really great. For example, tonight, after we talk about the Space Foundation Symposium, we're going to talk about what he has found out about the Europa Clipper mission. And one article that really caught my attention was the flying taxis that are coming into our world. And you'll hear a lot to say about that, plus other things. But we're going to welcome Tom to the Space Show and start talking about the symposium. Hi, Tom. Welcome to our program. And it's really great to meet you on the phone and to have you here.
Yeah, good evening, David. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, we are the official magazine of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. We are the group that has about 30,000 members around, worldwide, ranging from the chairman of Boeing to college students working on their engineering degree, people who, you know, the president of JAXA, the Japanese Space Agency, is a member. So check it out. We have conferences. We have, you know, programs for students and people learning. This is where we get our money from. We get our money from the membership, and every member gets a magazine. So come and check it out, please.
So this sounds like my sponsor message, because AIAA is a sponsor, and I read their message at the top of the second segment. So that's
great.
That's almost
I love talking about that, because they're such a resource. You know, all these conferences we have all year, I get to learn so much. And I first learned about this flying taxis subject so well a year ago at our aviation conference.
Yeah,
when so many people came to present.
Start us off with the Space Symposium. So of all the programming, and it's really jam-packed programming and networking to die for and global, not just U.S.-oriented, what was the program or the panel or the speaker, or what got your attention the most? What did you find most valuable at the symposium from your perspective?
For me as a reporter, and all the other reporters there, were very appreciative of Air Force generals and the Secretary of Air Force herself, Heather Wilson, coming to meet with us and have a roundtable with just us reporters, about a dozen or more every time. And they announced plans for trying to streamline acquisition in the Air Force space acquisition for military satellites. So they announced they're going to appoint the chief architect in there, tasking Lieutenant General Thompson with a plan by October to reorganize things. And they're trying to do it with the same staffing, so nobody's going to lose their jobs. All the contracts will be the same for the near future, but they're trying to figure out within a year or so, they figure it out, announce plans in October, and then they start implementing the plan. So it's going to take a while, but they want to make it faster to get a satellite into space, which is a good thing, because they want to keep the technology in space up to date, so it'll be protected from hackers and jammers and foreign powers, and just to make sure, because they have missile warning satellites, GPS satellites. GPS is not a military satellite per se, but you get the idea that there's space is a warfighting domain was the talking point of all the generals. So they all had their own perspective from their different commands, but in general, they're trying to make it faster to keep good military technology in space to just protect our interests. They were very careful. The generals were careful not to mention Russia and China. Heather Wilson, who's the Secretary of the Air Force, but she mentioned Russia and China by name, how they're developing capabilities to disable our satellites. So there were a lot of defense reporters there, and because space is an Air Force command, and we're trying to figure out how they're going to try to protect satellites from the Russians and Chinese, what exact technology they have. General Hyten, who is the general in charge of Strategic Command, missiles,
right?
He confirmed that Russia and China are developing hypersonics. That's a mouthful, but in short, the meetings with the generals and the Secretary of the Air Force were just invaluable. We didn't get to go to the classified sessions, but we got to learn a lot about what the Air Force is doing.
Are we developing hypersonics? Are we doing what? Did they tell you what we're doing to combat this, or to challenge, or to compete?
I I didn't hear, well, we were more interested in what Russia and China were and weren't capable of, but elsewhere, there's been defense writer meetups where the head of DARPA told us that we were developing hypersonics, even though the Chinese and the Russians have been investing significantly in it. So we may be catching up a bit, but we are, I guess we're definitely competing.
Did any of the generals or did Heather Wilson, did anybody ask them any questions? Because this is not really space related, but it's Air Force related. We hear all the time about how we have pilot shortage, we have spare parts shortage, where, you know, our planes are not always ready, and, you know, the state of the Air Force or even, you know, the Navy planes are not where they should be. Was there anything said about readiness capability and the status of, do we have enough people in the Air Force? Do we have enough pilots? Do we have enough spare parts? Can we actually carry out the mission, or are there real shortages for us?
That wasn't discussed at the Space Symposium, but I have gone to recent Air Force events, Navy and Air Force aviation events, where, you know, generals will talk about how there's a pilot shortage for sure, and they want to, especially with the tankers, the aerial refueling tankers, those need pilots, and you literally can't run these people, because you need to be flying these things around the world all the time. You need people to sleep. You need more people to do it, and they don't really want to automate it, so at least definitely not in the near future. So, that's the main, other than that, they're getting the money that they need. And it's mainly the pilot shortage. You're very right to point that out. In civilian world, too, there's a shortage of commercial pilots.
Did you come away feeling, let me do it this way, because ever since I've been doing the space show, and we're going back almost 17 years, in fact, coming up is the 17th birthday of the space show, there have been programs on the space show about no weapons in space, no militarization of space, you know, keep it civil, keep it commercial. Even the generals don't want militarization and weaponization of space. And now we always hear about space as a warfighter domain. We need to be prepared for this, that, and the other. Something has clearly changed over the recent last 5 or 6 or 7 years, or maybe the media is just reporting more of it. Are we militarizing and somehow weaponizing space? I mean, it sounds to me from what I read and hear that in a way we're preparing to fight wars through space or in space.
I think the Air Force has a defensive position right now. There was an it's funny, I went to the Smithsonian this weekend and I saw an old anti-satellite missile that was made in the 80s, and they were going to launch them from planes, commercial planes, into space to hit satellites. So it's easy to hit a satellite. I mean, China did it. We did it. But we don't want to do that because that creates space junk. So it's much more likely there'll be a way to just disable them instead of destroy them. So I don't think there's a need to put weapons in space. I think there's more just, you know, like hypersonic missiles or something. If they can, improve missile technology, it'll be much easier to hit them and the event of a total war. But yeah, I don't think there's going to be actual weapons put in space in the near future, because everyone is concerned about jamming. And a big trend I've noticed is, you know, it's more about how they, you know, network the constellations of satellites, that to make sure that if one is disabled, then something else around the world will be connected to it and still pass on the information that it needs, or that it will have jamming resistance and it can't be disabled in the first place. It'll be like Advanced EHF, which is the satellite that the president talks on in the event of a nuclear war. That is the last resort communication satellite. It has more jam resistance and shielding than a normal satellite. So they're considering how to, you know, better protect satellites. It seems like it's defensive right now. But the Russians have steered a satellite around other satellites. So they've shown that they can, if they want to, crash one satellite into another or whatever. But it seems like, and I asked the generals about this, they do not mention Russia. They're trying to play nice. They want to get along in space. So the generals will not talk about Russia or China directly. But Secretary Wilson, for some reason, felt like comfortable mentioning them by name. But, yes, there's definitely a defensive posture right now. They're trying to make sure they can get military satellites into space faster with this reorganization they're doing at the Space and Missile Center. There's going to be a new official out at the Los Angeles Air Force Base who is going to lead this reorganization. So they hope they can keep, you know, like it's when you buy a new computer every few years. You want to get the latest technology. If you don't have a good computer, you can't do your job. So they're trying to make that happen in space by sending up more up-to-date satellites. And then, you know, they're trying to make the whole launch-deliver satellite, you know, deorbit satellite. They want to make that whole process faster. So they think they can do that by reorganizing the Pentagon. So that's of luck to them.
Reorganizing the Pentagon. Yeah, best of luck sounds like a good thing. Did when you heard the various generals speak and Heather Wilson speak, and you probably met and talked to a couple of them, I would imagine, in private networking around a drink or something like that. Personally, are you confident in the way the U.S. is proceeding a warfare capability in space, be it defensive or whatever it may be, that even if they're not telling us? From your vantage point, your experience, all of what you know, do you have a high level of confidence in all of this?
In my reporting, I go to these all the time, and they're taking. Yeah, I go to these events all the time, and they take space very seriously. So I can tell that they're paying attention. They talk about it often, and they're trying to make sure that they are doing it efficiently. So, yeah, from my reporting perspective, I think that I'm pretty confident because they mention it a lot. And, yeah, the Space Council is another way the government is trying to take space more seriously. They're trying to make sure that they have the backing of industry and that they coordinate the best they can with industry. Everybody wants to encourage the private space economy, so it's not just about militarization, such as it is. You know, when I write these stories, I'm very careful not to choose words like militarization or whatever, or commercial or whatever. But you get the point, is that the space business will help everybody, and I think that America has a very vibrant space business, so that's encouraging. That encourages me the most.
Aside from the Air Force generals and Heather Wilson, what got your attention the most? Was it the vice president? Was it something to do maybe with policy that we're going forward? Where did you see what you thought would be the best thing to write about, or that really grabbed your attention and was most impressive?
Well, I tell you, the vice president and the commerce secretary were two of the civilian officials who came out, and they both talked about how the commerce department is taking on space traffic management to clear junk from orbit to make sure that we can make room for new satellites and that we won't hit anything. So the Air Force already tracks space junk, and the vice president and the commerce secretary talked about how they're going to try to add space traffic management to its responsibilities. So that's encouraging.
How are they going to how are they planning to get rid of the junk? What's the commerce department going to do that's different than other things?
Oh, that's a good question. But they just say that they're going to start doing that. So a lot of these discussions were how, okay, we understand this. We're going to, you know, create this new. Yeah, you know, they're going to add a whole new portfolio to it. So it's a process, but they're trying to, and this was happening in the Obama administration too. They, you know, this is an ongoing, that's what's great about NASA, is that it progresses and it has to deal with presidents, because sometimes presidents will change plans or focuses, like moon, Mars, moon, like, you know, the Bush administration, the Obama administration, now the Trump administration. But they try to be ready no matter what. And it seems like the space business has continued, and the government is just trying to encourage that because people are coming up with plans to do that. There's discussions about how to clear junk from orbit. Like, there's, you know, they're tracking it so we can just avoid it for now, but they'll come up with something more permanent.
I'll read this question. This is Jack, Jack is in Dallas, Texas, and he said, did you get a chance to hear Commerce Department Wilbur Ross speak? Does he know anything at all about space? Was he a fast learner, or is he a fast learner? did you get the impression that he's really interested in and capable of handling space activities in the Commerce Department?
Rather than offer you my opinion, I will give you facts. I will tell you that me and most of the other reporters did not go to Vice President and Pence's and Wilbur Ross's speeches. We were instead guests of Lockheed Martin, and they took us out to go see their GPS-3 satellite factory on Monday. So I wasn't there to hear them, and it wasn't a very dramatic announcement. It just kind of isn't a reminder that the government is paying attention. You know, it's a good, you know, it was, the fact that it wasn't a huge surprise is a good thing, because we're confident that the government is taking space seriously, and they, you know, the Trump administration is very, very keen on encouraging private space companies that will own their own stuff, and not so NASA and the Air Force won't own everything. They want other companies to do things on their own with money from the government. So we kind of saw that coming. You know, we didn't think it would be very dramatic. And besides, it was so much cooler to go to a satellite factory and to see all this. We saw the lunar habitat concepts that Lockheed Martin is working on, too. They just, it was, that's what's great about the Space Symposium, is that all the big companies come and they show off their stuff. And some of them, like Lockheed Martin, has a factory nearby up in Colorado Springs, because NORAD is there, too. And Schriever Air Force Base is out there. It's just a great place for the space industry. So, yeah, that was more interesting for us than the policy announcements.
When you looked at a GPS satellite, I mean, I've been to Loral, and I've seen DirecTV satellites in the high bay. Could you tell you were looking at a GPS satellite? Do they look anything different from any other satellite if you're sort of just a layman and not a trained satellite viewer?
Well, it's still being put together. There's lots of wires sticking out, and it's in pieces. So it was in, like, two giant pieces, and they were going to put them together. But it was funny. We were in a clean room,
uh-huh.
So we put on the booties and the hats and the whole, you know, the smock and everything.
Right.
So we walk around in there. So, yeah, it's not painted. It's not completed yet. It doesn't have the shielding. So, yeah, it looks it's still being made.
So this factory is in Colorado Springs.
It's north of it. It's in Waterton.
Oh, okay. If I were there, I'd have probably gone to see the satellite too. So that would have been a lot of fun. In terms of networking, did you meet some unusual people? Did you learn anything through the, you know, I was ex-Navy, so through the scuttlebutt? Kind of thing that maybe you didn't know before that you can explore for future articles or future research?
My favorite people that I met were from all around the world. This is such an international event, and it's, you know, the Japanese are there. I met people from Singapore. I met the Singapore, people from the Singapore Ministry of Defense who were there, and they're trying to expand their space program. Singapore, you know, it's not a huge one right now, but there are people there learning about it. Dubai and everybody from all over. There are a few Russian reporters there. There weren't as many Russians there this year. I was disappointed by that. But it seems like the head of Roscosmos, Igor Komarov, just legitimately was busy and couldn't make it. He sent someone else from Roscosmos, and he gave a very nice speech about Russia and America coordinating on the lunar space station that they would like to build. So it's this very international event. It's kind of inspiring. I like that about the people who I met. You know, people from Germany. I sat at an awards dinner with someone who works for DLR, you know, the German space agency.
Right. Fascinating. Was there anything there that related specifically to sort of the new entrepreneurial commercial space or the new space industry? I know they blended in with everything else, but did anything from the emerging commercial space and the new space side stand out for you?
Well, I liked all the small companies that were there. There were the big companies in this one section of the Broadmoor Hotel, and then there's a pavilion where they have all these small companies who sell wires and computers and small launch providers that are, you know, like, hey, this is my tiny booth, but I have an actual rocket that I can sell you. You know, it's like going to a small trade show, except everyone's selling parts of rockets. It's pretty cool. So it's encouraging that there's still some small providers who can help build a rocket by doing one part and doing it well, and you know, therefore they'll make some money off of it. So that was encouraging to see that.
Did you come across Rocket Lab? I'm interested if they're really going to get their Electron rocket to go to the moon later this year. So I'm
I met their CEO. What's their CEO's name again? Oh yeah, I interviewed him about. I got a scoop about the National Reconnaissance Office trying to put out a request for proposal to arrange a small launch vehicle to launch small spy satellites into space just for them, just for the NRO.
Uh-huh.
And so I asked the head of Electron if he was going to bid for this contract. He said he'd have to see it first. But there's a big emphasis on small launch during the symposium. You know, rockets that are, like, you know, the orbital ATK Minotaur, that was
right.
the metric that they used. When I interviewed the NRO, they said that anything smaller than an orbital ATK Minotaur would be, you know, they would consider small launch for their purposes. And there's not really a definition of what is a small launch rocket or launch vehicle. DARPA was very interested in that. They're offering $10 million to anybody who can do this one particular small launch vehicle challenge. So everybody wants to be able to get small things into space quickly for less money.
Did the CEO of a Rocket Labs talk about the upcoming lunar mission, or that wasn't part of your conversation?
No, we didn't talk about the lunar mission. He's still trying to get his rocket business going. He just made a deal with He made this deal with this spaceport owner, I think in New Zealand, because they have their launch pad in New Zealand.
In New Zealand, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There was this. Look that up, readers. Listeners. Look that up. There was a deal he announced last week that I tried to include in my story, but I had to cut it out because it wasn't related to the NRO contract.
Celestis has a payload on their Electron rocket to the moon, and my mom and two dogs are a part of that payload, so I have a vested interest in that Electron rocket making it to the moon, but I'm not holding my breath, but I'd love to see it be successful. So guess we'll find out later this year.
Oh yeah, the White House is very interested in encouraging the space industry, so they want to they want everyone to have a chance. The strategy is that NASA will go to the moon again first, and the companies will follow right behind them. So once the government does it, private industry will feel more comfortable doing it too.
Okay, so I need to ask you for some clarifications, though, as a really high-quality journalist. So I'm totally confused, and I think listeners are totally confused. So you say NASA's strategy is to go to the moon first, but all of what we hear is NASA's strategy is the LOPG platform, which is not going to the moon. And it's in an orbit that isn't easy to get to the moon, but it is easier to maybe do something and go to Mars from the LOPG. But maybe they'll do AI type of rovers in early 2020s, but not human rovers, or at least not for a while. So what is it? And then I hear from Marcia Smith, who you probably know, and other people, that they don't have funding to go to the moon anyway. So what is the reality here, other than the rhetoric? Can you parcel this out for us and clear up my confusion, which means you'll clear up everyone else's confusion too?
I don't want to inject too much opinion to this, so I will, instead of saying rhetoric, I will say promises.
Okay.
Because NASA for years has been making promises. Like, they started the Constellation program under the Bush administration.
Right.
You can kind of track the evolution of what this is, because NASA was going to go to Mars. I went to the Human Exploration Advisory Committee last year. They were talking about building spacecraft. It was on paper. This whole thing was on paper that, 20 years in advance of how they were going to build a lunar space station. And from there, they were going to assemble a spacecraft that could take you to Mars. At the end of it, this is after the Trump administration began, they said this spacecraft could go anywhere. We would just use this lunar space station in a sweet spot between the moon and Earth. It's called a Lagrange point. So it's a neutral orbit, and it basically doesn't go anywhere. So it could be a stable place for a station. And there, you would also assemble in a couple of pieces, you would launch them from Earth, and they would be at this orbit. And then you would put together the space station, and then it would go wherever you want it to go. It would go to Mars. It would go to Mars. But they just wanted to say this is what they could do. And that space that spaceship has now been put on hold to build a lander for the moon. That was, I went to the meeting this year, a year later, in March, and they said the priority is now to build a lunar lander, to land humans on the moon. So they are strategizing 20 years in advance because it takes a long time to build things. It takes a long time to build anything at NASA. And that's why they and the Air Force want to speed things up. But they are still working on what the space station would be like. So they're going to build a space station. They started to do the power propulsion elements. It's kind of a solar panel, solar propulsion piece. I'll have to check that later. But yeah, they have physical concepts for that part, and the rest of it, the space contractors like Sierra Nevada, Lockheed Martin, Boeing are all proposing these concepts for what a lunar habitat for humans in space would be like. So it's very much in the promises stage. It's not rhetoric or whatever, I don't want to be opinionated about it, but they're definitely still planning and they have not done anything yet.
But the timeline is going to be pretty far out there, right?
Yeah, the timeline, well, right now they have the Space Launch System, so they're putting together the big rocket. The biggest rocket that, they call it the most powerful rocket that has ever been built. And this is tied in with that Europa Clipper story that we were talking about earlier.
Okay.
Is that they built this massive rocket this is where they're going right now. They're going to launch a test flight of this rocket. And called EM1, I think 2021. Let me check the dates here. But first they're going to test fly the rocket and they're going to launch it around the moon. And then the rocket's going to come back and then they'll launch humans on it the second time once they know it's safe. Because they'll put the rocket through a big, test flight. It'll be an unmanned test flight. It's like test flying a jet, because the jet could obviously explode or, whatever. So they want to make sure it's safe and then they'll launch humans and then they'll orbit the moon and they will let off satellites along the way. And they could do some telerobotics, but it will be good to have humans back in deep space for the first time since the early 70s. So they thought about launching humans on the first flight and they decided not to do that. So it could be till 2024 until humans get back up there. And that's as far as they are. That's as far as is on paper. That's what they're going to. That's as far as they've actually got right now.
Let's switch from the space symposium topic and talk about some of the other things that are going on. So one of the things that caught my attention to invite you to the space show was your article on space taxis, which this was all news to me when I read it in Aerospace America. What is a space taxi?
Sky taxi.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, we've been talking about space, so it's okay. We're switching now to a sky taxi is a service that aircraft manufacturers and other companies are considering. Uber is just one of the people who's considering this. They coordinate all these companies, like property owners, electronics companies, aircraft manufacturers, to build and basically every technology that was used to make drones and automation, distributed electric propulsion, things like that. They're trying to make drones that are big enough to carry people, and they would be automated, ideally in the future, to carry humans from one part of the city to the next, kind of like a bus or a tram would have been, those old-timey trams over a river.
Uh-huh.
Kind of like that. Yeah, like that. Like, they could basically hop you across the river. Like, one of the concepts is San Francisco. It could take you from downtown San Francisco to some point in the suburbs. So, hops like that on pre-routed flights. And they have the technology from drones to do this because the drone industry took off. And so people are confident that they can actually do this now. And the designs with distributed electric propulsion are so good. One of the problems was old mechanical designs required too many motors and required too many sources. Like, now batteries and wiring and other technology like that are so good, you can have one battery and many motors across the drone that would carry the person, you know, the big drone, basically. And it would make it easier for them. That's why they have so many small propellers, because they can have so many motors, and if one fails, they can still land safely. There's a lot of design, but that's a popular one where they have about 8 small propellers. And so they would lift one person in an automated program to just hop from one place to the next, and it would cut your commute in half on a very busy day. If you're late for work, you can be at work in 10 minutes if you live in the suburbs.
But only one person at a time would use one?
Most designs right now, at first they're just trying to make it work, but there would be no pilot because there would be the extra weight and all the other design problems that come with that. But also automation could make it easier to program. These are years away, but NASA and the FAA are working on a study. They've contracted out a study to figure out the best ways for them to, you know, help companies who, because a lot of companies are coming to them for help. They always do when they have new aircraft ideas. But that's what the agencies are there for. And so that they're working with companies to make this easier, to figure out what kind of safety regulations they need to do, what kind of tests they need to do on the aircraft, the modeling, and also would people even want to do that? How can you convince people that this is safe? That's the biggest what if, is not just can we do this, but can we make money off of this? Because who is going to want to do this? I told my girlfriend about this. She says, no, you're not doing it first.
Do you have any information on specs, like what altitude it would fly from downtown San Francisco to the suburbs, for example?
They're still working on that. The one that is, you know, really it is all up in the air, because you have to think about what's the wind like. Is it too heavy? What kind of power would it need? Air traffic management is a big concern, because that's one reason the FAA is involved, because that's what they do. They do air traffic management. So they're trying to, if all these small aircraft are flying around and there's also planes flying in and out of the city and there's birds, and, you know, what if you think about how can you route the safe path for these? So, you know, the FAA is thinking about air traffic management in its other, you know, capacities too. So they're just extending it to this. So that's those are a couple of the big what ifs for this, to make this happen.
And you think the timeline is years and years away then?
Not years away. You know, it depends on how fast they work. But NASA and the FAA have contracted the study by the year's end. And A Cubed, which is the Silicon Valley arm of Airbus, is putting out an announcement tomorrow. I talked to them today. The one that may be the farthest along is called the Vahana. It's an aircraft. It's a small aircraft with a few propellers, and they're testing it in Pendleton, Oregon, and they're doing some work in California on it as well. But they're having an announcement out tomorrow. Just they're flight testing it, so they have a full scale demonstrator. But others are still being tested, so it's really the regulations would need to make it possible for the aircraft and vice versa. But I think the aircraft will be finished before the regulations are done. Well, you know, we'll see. But you get my point, is the technology is definitely coming.
You have an email and a caller on hold. Linda in Portland, Oregon says, we don't have a perfected driverless car yet. They cause accidents and problems all over the place. And now they're talking about driverless planes to take people to and from work over major cities. This sounds a little bit like science fiction to me.
Too many people, you're right. You're very right to be skeptical. This is one reason I like Aerospace America more than U.S. News and World Report, is because I am forced to meet a higher standard of engineering. You know, people who build, you know, work for NASA and the Air Force and lots of companies read this magazine. So I can't just, you know, there's no hype behind this. This is so much money being poured into this. And you're right, it could be a bad gamble, but it will be a disastrous gamble. There are so many people spending money on this. But I think also, you know, self-driving cars are not as dangerous. Well, we don't know. They have not been put on too many public roads yet. But the roads that they've been put on, you know, humans make mistakes all the time when they're driving. I think that and electric cars too. Electric cars are not as dangerous as gasoline cars. I think that there's enough legal room there that they can be made safe. I mean, automation and new technologies are always tough to integrate, but I think that, you know, because I mentioned electricity because the batteries are a problem, too. If you're flying in an electrical aircraft, the battery could fail and you could fall out of the sky. So I think that both of those technologies are getting safe enough for us to have them. But you're right. The biggest question with self-driving cars is, do we want a self-driving car? Do we want that in our neighborhood, even if we're not driving it? So you're right to be skeptical.
Let's see who your caller is. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is Marshall in the flatlands of Oklahoma.
Okay.
I was going to ask a slightly different question, but since you're on the topic, I'd like to ask you, which is easier to do, a drone aircraft or an autonomous car?
Well, we already have autonomous cars, so that's it right there. You know, but I think that the tougher question will be the market for both of those, because, you know, companies are studying. One reason the FAA and the and NASA are doing the study is because they want to see how they can convince the public it's safe and how they can, you know, what companies should do when they want to make the service. Not everyone wants to provide the service, and some of them just want to build the aircraft. But either way, people will have to be comfortable with these things flying over their heads and landing near them. There could be a noise problem. So yeah. There's all sorts of ways they need to integrate them into our lives. I think that we already have autonomous cars, so they won that race, but the regulations for both of them are still coming.
Yeah, I agree with you. The problem is really the regulations, because you have Global Hawk, you have the Neely Aero, there's a whole bunch of drones out there, and as long as they stay on military bases, you know, they seem to be fairly safe, no problems. But you're right, out in the general public, there's the problem. The next thing is, all these people are doing these proposals, and the request for proposals costs a whole lot of money. How much money is these different companies putting in just doing, writing up proposals to submit?
I'm glad I don't have to know that, because I write about the engineering side of it. And I don't write about the that would be a different publication, like specifically for the federal government, like maybe government executives, maybe some other defense publications who pay closer attention to the money and the actual business of defense contracting. I don't know. So I'm glad I don't have to know.
No,
because you're right. It could be a problem.
Yeah. I have worked on some back in the ancient history years. I worked on several proposals, and it's kind of like, oh, my gosh, they're spending $1 million in hopes of landing, a $500 million contract. And that's just to be in the group of people that move from the request for proposals up to just the first design phase. And it's kind of like, oh, my gosh. And, you hear a lot of people talking about, well, this idea is cool, but they can't take it anywhere because they don't have the funding even to bring it up to a straw man proposal level. Is that a problem that you see?
It's difficult. You still have to make the proposals to see what people are willing to do, because some people don't, there's sometimes one competitor for a contract because this one company has shown so strong interest in it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's all the fun I have, and hopefully we can get people to high-quality people to get out there and make more proposals, because that's where the real leading edge of technology is.
Yeah, for sure.
Marshall, are you seeing self-driving cars in your part of Oklahoma?
Well, we have almost got to the point of having self-driving tractors to plow fields. Think about that.
I guess that's similar. I don't know.
Well, the key thing is when you're out on a wheat field,
yeah,
there's nothing to run into.
I guess stumps or something, right? Maybe.
I mean, we're talking wheat fields that are half mile long and a half mile wide, and it's flat within like 10 feet from one corner to the other corner. And there's nothing out there but dirt, literally. And, yeah, you can pretty much sit on the tractor and, you know, and it will auto-steer and plow the field. The key thing that you have to have is very straight rows to use what's called a stripper header that strips the wheat out without cutting all the stalks off. And, yeah, it's high technology. And if you go to the wheat elevators, almost every wheat elevator within 50 or 100 miles of here all have differential GPS towers on them. So everybody gets down to that, you know, 4 or 5 inches, you know, making that row of wheat or milo or corn or canola straight.
Interesting.
Yeah, and it's, this isn't cheap stuff either. We're talking about $500,000 for a piece of equipment. So.
Okay, Marshall, I appreciate your call, okay?
Yeah.
Thank you very
much. Next time, bye.
Okay, bye-bye. So, listeners, that does open up our line if you want to use it, 1-866-687-7223. We're going to move to our break because we're a few minutes behind on our break. So everybody stay where you are, and we'll be back with Tom in about 3 minutes. Don't go anywhere. The phone number, if you want to call us, and we can talk to you during the break and then bring you up first, 1-866-687-7223. Be right back.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. You are in part two of the Space Show. I want to thank our part two sponsors, Orbital ATK. They're a global leader in aerospace and defense technology and the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense. We have a program with Orbital ATK this Friday morning on the Omega A project. It's a rocket project, and they actually announced it at the Space Foundation. Did you see that announcement or hear about it, Tom?
I did, yes. I wrote a story about it. I was so there's so much going on that I had to run over to get this announcement right the Monday night. And I wrote about this new rocket that they're going to plant, the Omega.
Well, I don't yet know who my guest is going to be. This is really funny, but...
Well, the big announcement they made is that Aerojet Rocketdyne is going to make the upper stage liquid propulsion engine for that. And they chose it because the liquid propulsion makes it easy to fine-tune in orbit. So that was a really cool detail.
Also, AIAA, as we mentioned earlier, is our sponsor, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. 30,000 individual members, 88 countries, 95 corporate members, incredible networking at their events. Their people are active in the industry, so they shape the industry every day. Their website, AIAA.org, you need to go to events and meet the people and join. You don't have to be an engineer to join. I'm not an engineer, and I'm a member. It's a great organization. And then Celestis is our sponsor. We also mentioned them a little earlier. They are still the only proven Memorial spaceflight service provider in the world. They have a very robust schedule for 2018, including their suborbital flight with Up Aerospace in New Mexico, a seventh orbital mission out of the Cape later this year on a Falcon Heavy, the Luna mission, which we talked about a little while ago with Electron Rocket in Mahia, New Zealand, and that's the Moon Express launch, and also Celestis is on that launch. And then they have a Voyager mission, which is going to launch fourth quarter. And then they have a Vandenberg Air Force Base Falcon 9 mission. And what a great way to memorialize and honor loved ones. And also you can send your own DNA to space. You can join with your loved one and put some of your DNA in the capsule as well and go to space with your loved one. So for more information, contact Celestis, CELESTIS.com. And we have a caller on hold, and then we're going to talk in a few minutes about Europa. So one of my very favorite topics. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is John in Fort Worth.
Hi there. What's on your mind?
Well, I was he's been at these conferences and talking to people in the news. And something in the news I think is rather provocative, interesting, is the Russian announcement of a, quote, nuclear-powered cruise missile with an indefinite range or something to that effect. I was wondering, has he heard anything about that, and what do the experts he talks to think about that subject?
Yeah, well, thank you for calling. Yeah, we were at the meetings with General Hyten this past week, and he confirmed that the U.S. has observed their tests of a hypersonic missile. So, yeah, he didn't go into too much detail. But he did confirm that, they've been testing that.
Because, I mean, this thing, I mean, there's two things discussed, but the particular one they've discussed is something that would be analogous to a program that we, I guess, toyed around with about, would it be now, 55 years ago, 58 years ago? And that was this Project Pluto. You know, I mean, it's a very provocative thing. The article I was reading on this thing from this NPR article here, and they're like, this is pretty crazy flight testing this puppy, you know? Because it has a nuclear reactor on it to power it. So it doesn't need, you know, like a hydrocarbon fuel to keep going. It can, you know.
Yeah, the hypersonic missiles sound incredible. There's a lot. And the U.S. is doing work on that, too, and China.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yep, we're going to get there's discussion about civil hypersonics. I think. There's been talk about that too. So there's a lot of propulsion technology happening.
Yeah, I know that in the hypersonic field. I mean, we're obviously working on, you know, and as are they, very fast missiles that, and there've been projects going back to that X-43, and then there was a Boeing project too that followed on after that. I think that. Where they would launch something and try to get it to fly hypersonically and scramjets and things of that sort.
Now, I remember now, yeah, I interviewed the chairman of Boeing, Dennis Muilenburg, at the start in January, and he said he can foresee a future where there's a commercial hypersonic jet. The industry is thinking about this for sure. Everyone is thinking about ways to develop hypersonics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think that's happening, but this particular Russian project sounds a bit dangerous if they're really going to fly a nuclear reactor around in the air. I mean,
missile defense is weird these days. They're talking about low yield nukes or short range nukes. So there's all this. It's hard to decipher. We were talking about this with the latest missile defense plan by the governments. So this is an ongoing conversation of different types of missiles.
Yeah. Well, I just thought that was interesting. What was in my words? I guess they're not. They're getting a little. They're pretty. It sounds like they're pretty closed-mouthed about the details on this. It sounds like.
Yeah, they don't want anyone to know what they know. So General Hyten wouldn't tell us details, but he said, yes, we've seen them do it. We know that Russia and China are testing these.
Do they seem concerned about it? Could you tell anything like that about it?
Well, they're military men, so they're very, you know, stoic. They say they're definitely taking it seriously. They mention the threats, but General Raymond was very careful not to mention Russia and China, as I mentioned. You know, they try not to agitate because they want to work with the Russians and the Chinese in space. They can't work directly with the Chinese, but they want to, you know, coordinate on projects with the Russians. They seem to take it very seriously.
Does all the Trump collusion stuff, did that show up in any of the Air Force talks or anything vis-a-vis Russia?
No. That doesn't seem related. Because the space agencies, I mean, we worked with the Russian space agency during the Cold War, so political scandal won't get in the way of that.
So that part doesn't enter into space relations with Russia, from what you can tell.
I was hoping to have more conversations about Russia. The head of the Russian space agency was supposed to come, and he was supposed to have a media roundtable with us. About a dozen of us showed up for every meeting with the general.
Uh-huh.
So I assume a lot of us would have gone to this meeting with him. So we didn't get to have that conversation.
Well, you'll have to go to Moscow and have it over there.
Yeah, I'd love to go to Star City. Star City is their big space headquarters near Moscow. I'll let you check that out.
Absolutely. John, do you have anything additional for our guest tonight?
Well, I guess I just was curious what they knew about that. Another reason why I was kind of interested in that topic is that the technologies involved in such a nuclear propelled ramjet essentially. A lot of those technologies would also transfer to nuclear thermal propulsion for space, although it's going to be a little bit different because the working fluid would be different, i.e. probably hydrogen rather than air. But, you know, I just think it's the energy source would be very similar, you know. And if the Russians are developing that, I've often thought that if you were to eventually have a future joint space program, the one thing the Russians might be able to bring to the table would be a nuclear thermal rocket, which might be harder to develop here in the U.S. with the environmental laws we have and all, and they're a little more, you know, free if the government decides to do it over there.
I don't know about that. I mean, the government uses plutonium all the time. We know a lot of our spacecraft are powered by plutonium to keep, you know, the constant heat source. So I think, you know, they're open to nuclear power.
But it would require the actual. If you go back to what we were doing in the 60s and 70s, we were up to the nerve, it was canceled. We were actually, you know, firing the rockets at a test site at Jackass Flats, and that and sometimes involves pieces of radioactive material spewing out of the atmosphere if it doesn't work right. And the environmental things put a lot of pressure on stopping it, as well as budget constraints, I think, in the early 70s. And I was thinking the Russians might be able to bring that to the table where we might bring maybe the lander or the life support or something else, you know.
Oh, yeah, they're definitely talking about what each of them can do.
Yeah. I'll get off and see if anybody else.
Okay, you're through, you're through, John?
Yeah, I'm through. I just thought I'd bring those ideas up.
Thank you very much for your call. Listeners, that does open the line, and again, it is 1-866-687-7223. Let's go to Europa. So, was there anything about Europa at the Space Symposium?
No, there was just, everybody who was there knew the big projects, and they all, there wasn't a lot, I liked this, it was kind of straight to business, because everyone, there was talk about going to the moon, but the cool part was everyone there was already a space expert. They already knew what the big plan was and what the goals were, and they talked about, okay, how can we get this done? And that, it was a business meeting about this. So, but I have been researching the Europa Clipper mission. They want to send a probe to Europa because they think that is one of the planets. It's the Jovian moon, the moon of Jupiter, and they want to Yeah, they want to search for signs of life from orbit. They don't want to land there yet, but they want to land there. There's people who are like John Culberson in the House, who's very excited about the prospect of life on Europa. He wants to have a lander there, and he is one of its biggest champions. He is, you know, it is a law to, he said this is a mission that it is illegal to not do. So they are building the satellite to orbit Europa, and they want to get it there as soon as possible. And the fastest way to do that would be to launch it on the Space Launch System. So the plan, the official plan approved by Congress and signed by Trump, is to launch it on the Space Launch System because it's the only rocket we have that's powerful enough to fly directly to Europa or to fly directly to Jupiter and then inject into Jupiter's orbit in that way. Because flying directly, yeah. So, but any other spacecraft would have to fly on a rocket that would have to orbit Venus and get a gravity assist to fly out there. So it could, it wouldn't be powerful enough to fly there directly. So the Trump administration is considering, should the Space Launch System be made exclusively for human exploration? Because they want to make sure that the rocket will be available to launch humans to the moon and to get that project going. But other people have said, no, this is, you know, this would be the fastest way to do it. And it's a really fascinating mission because this is the best chance so far to look for life within our solar system. And if there are signs of, you know, there's signs of organic matter in orbit, or, you know, the waste product of organic matter in orbit, then they would say, okay, there's enough evidence here that we can launch a lander, and they'll spot for good landing sites because it's a planet of ice, essentially, such as it is, you know, not exactly like Earth ice. But they want to see that they think that the water underneath it is enough like Earth's water that there could be life down there. So they want to get this project moving as soon as possible. The sooner we get results back, the sooner the lander mission can start.
So initially, this mission was going to have a lander, but then they changed that plan, right?
There's been a conversation. I don't want to get into the whole weeds of it, but yeah, the lander concept exists.
So,
not the concept, but the idea of doing a lander, yeah.
So the to use the SLS, it gets you there faster and simpler, but it costs a lot more money. So is that a good trade? So are the brains behind this saying the faster speed is worth the added money?
It would take half as much time. It could take, you know, 3 years to do the directly, and it could take 7.5 years. To travel with the gravity system Venus and every other rocket. You know, the NASA JPL engineers told me that from what they know about the Falcon Heavy, the Falcon Heavy would not be powerful enough to fly there directly. They're still getting information, but the main candidate right now would be the Delta IV Heavy built by the United Launch Alliance. And all these companies are building these different rockets, like the Space Launch System is built by Boeing, Aerojet Rocketdyne, and they want, all these companies are involved in building all these different rockets. Like Orbital ATK, that's who's doing the boosters. That's right. Yeah. So this is it's a massive rocket, and it's the only one powerful enough to fly there directly. So they're looking at other commercial options because the Trump administration is trying to encourage commercial space. And for right now, it seems John Culberson is going to push to keep SLS as the rocket to launch the Clipper, because that would mean that they can launch in 2022, and that launch date is up for grabs, too, because the Space Launch System could be launching one of the EM-1 missions, the test flight around the moon, as a prelude to sending humans to orbit the moon. So there's a whole discussion about how fast this mission should happen and what rocket it should launch on.
Are they actually making the Europa Clipper hardware?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The satellite is being built. It's being built, and the probe is being built. So that's going to be ready in time. They want that to be ready in, let's see, when did they want that ready? But they want it ready to be to launch in 2022.
So I'm assuming that's a launch window for Europa. I don't know very much about Europa launch windows.
Yeah, that's the launch window, and they want it to be ready to launch by then.
So SLS needs to get going if they're going to use it, because they have a lot of delays from time to time. So they're behind the eight ball, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are. they keep they've had to extend it from what they when it was originally proposed years ago. They began this, you know, this rocket began during the Bush administration, and the Obama administration kept the rocket, the pieces of the rocket, and it's been built. It's been built ever since then. So yeah, there's a push to have it because they want to have this first mission in 2019, at the end of 2019. So the manned mission could be 2022 or 2023. So they're trying to keep this. Yes, no, wait. Yes, 2022 is exploration mission two, and it would also be the year the Europa Clipper launches on its way to Jupiter. So the Space Launch System could be up twice in 1 year, and there's a discussion about whether that's possible.
You have Josh in Albuquerque, New Mexico, with an email, and he said, is there widespread congressional and NASA support for the Clipper mission, or is this really being pushed through by John Culberson because of his interest?
He's the loudest voice for this particular mission, but he is, you know, in good company. A lot of people want to. NASA launched the probe Galileo to Jupiter, and that's when they saw Europa and its potential to support life. And they were so confident about that that they flew the Galileo probe into Jupiter to avoid it contaminating Europa. They didn't want it to fly out there. They wanted to avoid the possibility of it crashing into Europa and contaminating whatever petri dish for life there is on Europa. So they people want to go there. It's just like everything else, why now? And John Culberson's argument is this could be the most important, you know, discovery of our lifetimes, to find signs of life there. And it would be inspiring. You know, people need to care about space again. So if we find something completely unexpected like that, this would spur interest. That's his argument. But everyone, yeah, everyone wants to check out Europa. It's one of the places for is Ganymede another one? Enceladus
is another one. Is another
these
one,
ice know. Planets are out there. So people want to look for life on these moons.
Listeners, I would like to point out that his article is in the April 2018 issue of Aerospace America. But if you were to look at page 38, he has an incredible graphic display of the launch choices and the benefits and cons of using SLS or Delta IV or Falcon Heavy. And he even shows the orbital diagrams of how it gets there, so with real important dates. So this is a keeper of a magazine and a keeper of an article if you're interested in Europa and what trade you want to do for this rocket or that rocket. It's a good lesson because you can apply it to a lot of other things as well. So, again, I just want to point it out. It's in the April 2018 edition of Aerospace America. And it's page 38, and their website, by the way, is aerospaceamerica.aiaa.org. And I don't know if you can access it without being an AIAA member, where you get Aerospace America with your membership. I don't know if it's widely available to the public or you have to be a member, but this is a keeper for sure, and you want to see that choice chart on page 38. Great job, Tom. It really clarifies the launch options for the Europa Clipper, for sure.
Yeah, it could be an amazing discovery if we find signs of life on, either Enceladus or Ganymede or Europa. This is NASA's really, like I said, NASA's in the promises stage, but they're thinking big and they're getting ambitious. So people say that we haven't done amazing things in space for a while. Well, the next 10 years is going to be very exciting because they're going to do stuff. It's going to be incredible.
We've got maybe 10 minutes left of our program tonight, and you were at the Bridenstine Senate confirmation hearing, correct?
Yes, I was at the Senate confirmation hearing. I wasn't there when he was sworn in this week, but I was at the confirmation hearing when he was being quizzed and questioned by Senate Democrats and Republicans.
Your takeaway?
The Senate Democrats viewed him as a controversial candidate, and they as a nomination. He's not a candidate, but you get my point. Because they were looking at his record during campaigning, during his term in Congress. where he made statements on radio shows about LGBT rights and climate change, and he voted in favor of, let's see, but I have a note here, because I'm trying to be very specific and just, you know, not just generalize, but he voted against extending the protections in the Violence Against Women Act to same-sex couples, and he was critical of climate change spending on the floor of the House. So, you know, they looked at his record, and they said, hey, we're not sure you can be the leader that NASA needs. We're not sure if you can, you know, encourage that you'll be inclusive, that you're not going to, because Senator Markey was concerned that there's a climate of fear among environmental scientists and people doing climate change related research. And he said that they're afraid that they'll be punished if they speak out against their work. And there's some degree of that, like, environment has become a buzzword to be careful of in government funding. People are careful to not, you know, just say, hey, my work is useful. It's not just a policy thing for climate policy. You know, there is that happening. So Bridenstine promised that he would not punish anybody speaking out about their work on climate change science. And people who were in the scientific community seem to want to give him a chance. And Bill Nye, you know, when he was his guest to the State of the Union this year, and Neil deGrasse Tyson, I interviewed him a few months ago. He's in this issue of Airspace America. I did a Q&A. He's on our April issue. And he said he would be more concerned if Bridenstine could learn on the job and embrace science and let the scientists do their job with the money that they are allowed. And so he's concerned. You know, he says, yeah, if he does that, he did fine. And if you know, but he says if we have an administrator who does not embrace science, then that will diminish America's role in space around the world. You know, other countries are building space agencies, and America has to, you know, embrace science and not, you know, stay in the way of that. So he thinks, you know, and I talked to people at the Space Symposium. I talked to about 8 different people, you know, to get comments, and I included a handful of them in a story that I wrote. Industry is very encouraged by him, too, because he actually proposed a bill that hasn't gotten out of committee called the Space Renaissance Act. He wanted to help encourage the private space economy. So that's one reason he was chosen by President Trump, is because he's shown friendliness to the space industry. And so everybody seems to want to give him a chance. So I'll be optimistic for his future. You know, he seems like he'll just, you know, NASA's popular no matter who is president, so he has a chance to get some things done.
Do we know anything about who his associate administrator and other staffers might be that come on board with him? Is there any information on that yet?
Let's see. Have they chosen an associate administrator? I'm not sure. I'm not sure if that would need to be appointed. But, Robert Lightfoot just, you know, gave his farewell speech at the Space Symposium, so he's leaving. A lot of people who are still in the Obama administration are still there. So I've spoken a number of times with Bill Gerstenmaier. He's the head of human space exploration.
Uh-huh.
He's the man taking us to Mars and the moon.
Did he have anything to say about Bridenstine?
No, he hasn't. He hasn't talked about, I've asked him, it most affects him. You know, the people who are in charge of NASA seems to keep going no matter who is president. So the big thing for the aid of directors like that are what do you want me to do now? What is my priority? So the Trump administration made clear the priority is the moon. So like I mentioned, they were going to build something called the deep space transport. They were going to build a spaceship. This is 20 years out. By 2030, they would have a spaceship built in lunar orbit. And that has now been put on hold so that they can land humans on the moon. So things like that. But in general, the technology is still being made. And I think that Bridenstine will do just fine, you know, because he really has to work hard to interfere with the work that's already being done if he wants to. You know, I think he'll do just fine.
More than likely, probably. I still think Congress will probably micromanage NASA. Do you see any change in that?
Congress needs to micromanage NASA because I went to a hearing a few years ago, I think it was 2014, where both Democrats and Republicans in the House Space Subcommittee were concerned that NASA didn't have a plan to go to Mars. They were concerned. They said, okay, you've made lots of promises. What are you doing? I need more details. How are you building this thing? And there wasn't enough details about things like that. So I think Congress can, you know, if that's one thing, that's one reason people are concerned about who becomes NASA administrator. You know, you could, there's work going on, but you need to make sure it's happening efficiently. You need to make sure that you're inspiring the public. You need to make sure that Congress knows that you're spending your money right. You know, so there's leadership needed, and I hope that he can rise to the occasion.
This is probably the last question of the day, and Paul is back with us from upstate New York, and he said, by chance at the symposium, was Scott Pace there, and did you get a chance to talk to him about any of these issues? Any thoughts about his role in the National Space Council and our future space policy?
I didn't notice Scott at the symposium, but I spoke with him a number of times before. Yeah, he's the right man for the job. I was very glad when he was chosen as one of the civilians on the Space Council because he definitely knows his stuff. He's, you know, friends to the press, always, you know, offering his perspective, his expertise. So I think that he, I think that he's giving good advice. There's a lot of people who just worked with NASA. You know, whatever you say about the Trump administration, people seem to be willing to let politics aside. I think that a lot of academics and people in industry and people in, you know, science communicators are just ready to work with the administration. And Scott is one of them. Scott is, he's part of the Space Council, and they're putting together their recommendations for President Trump on space. He wasn't at the symposium, but long story short, he's one of the people who is trying to offer good advice to the administration about how to manage space.
Yeah, he's very friendly. He comes on the space show from time to time, and, you know, he's a great guest. Was SpaceX present at the symposium and Blue Origin?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Blue Origin showed off its engine for the New Glenn rocket. And, you know, they were one of the people who showcased some things. SpaceX sponsored the awards dinner. They have an annual awards dinner for people designing game-changing technology for space. And, SpaceX was definitely present there.
Did you learn anything new about their agenda or timetables for their rocketry or anything like that?
No. Blue Origin and SpaceX are somewhat more secretive about their problem. Well, they're not as public as the more traditional players like Boeing and Northrop Grumman and Lockheed Martin, because they're still newer companies. But, yeah, I think that the Falcon Heavy launch a few months ago was the big development for now. Blue Origin was showing off the New Glenn, and they're still planning to launch that one. So, yeah, they're both in transition right now. The big, like, Orbital ATK named their Omega rocket. They're already working on that rocket, but they announced that they're moving forward with the engine. So other players had a chance to make news this time, but not really Lockheed. I'm sorry, not really SpaceX and not really Blue Origin as much as the others.
I have one final question that just came in, so I'll go ahead and ask it to you. It's Randy in Chicago. And he says, Tom, you sound like you're fairly young. How long have you been doing this, and what have been the greatest changes in the space industry since you've been doing space journalism?
Thank you for asking. I haven't done space journalism exclusively as a focus for very long, just a couple of years now. I've been a journalist for 10 years. I've worked for local newspapers and covered politics and written about business, and the past 6 years I have been doing technology. So I did general technology and tech policy and all that for a number of years, and when I was in the U.S. News and World Report, I started writing some stories about space. Like, I wrote about the anniversary of the shuttle, I wrote about the first spacewalk, and I covered some rocket explosion and launch explosions, and wrote about Scott Kelly's year in space, and I enjoyed it so much that I decided to do it full-time. And I wanted to work at a place that was very engineering-focused, you know, technical-focused. So Aerospace America has been the right fit. I've been there for, writing for them for a year and a half. I've been there full-time for a year, so I'm looking forward to getting into it more. I get to go to all these conferences, and it's great to bring you up to speed because I just get to meet all the people building everything. It's so exciting. So I encourage you to come to the IAA conferences, too. We're actually hosting the IAC next year. We're hosting the International Astronautical Congress here in Washington, D.C. So everyone, all the big wigs are going to be coming to us this time. That's late 2019. So that's how I've been, you know, such a quick study on space, because I get to go to so many of these great events with some of the smartest people I've ever met.
Have you noticed any evolution of a space story or anything since you started the space work that has really caught your attention?
Yes, I would say the supersonic jet. The cool thing about NASA these days is that they're doing their aeronautics part of their name, the first A in the two A's of their name. NASA's supersonic jet research to create a quieter sonic boom has progressed this past year. They finished up a concept proposed by Lockheed Martin, and then this year they formally gave them a contract to build the test plane, the X-plane, for NASA. And if it works, then they will have aerodynamic technology that would, the design of the plane to have a quieter sonic boom, to reduce it to a sonic thump is what they called it. That is their scientific term for it, to make it as quiet as closing a car door so that it won't... the goal is that the boom could go in 50 kilometers in any direction of the jet, because the boom, you know, breaks the sound barrier and you can hear it miles and miles away. So if they have lots of these commercial flights flying everywhere, then that's going to be really annoying. That's why we're not allowed to fly commercial flights supersonic speeds over land. And they want to make it quiet enough so people will be comfortable with that. That has advanced the most this past year.
There have been corporate executive jets trying to do this for corporate things for several years, and they've been trying to change the structure of the nose of the plane to reduce the sonic boom. Have you been following what the executive jets have been trying to do with this?
That's what the Concorde did, yeah. I think that it would take more than that, which is why NASA is doing it, because it's going to have to be such a game-changing design. But then, you know, once that design is done, they will, you know, give some information to companies so they can do it, because they want to encourage American companies to, in particular, to make supersonic jets. They're building them. Some of them are just making them in a more efficient way so that the jets are better. But, you know, without doing the new airframe design, they just want to have the business up and running. So when the new designs come out, then they'll be able to adapt their planes, and they'll already have a plane that they can adapt. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, I've been following this. I'm also really interested in it. I wish we had built the supersonic transport way back when, and instead of letting Concorde be the only one. But
some of these companies are just content to deal with the regulated environment right now and to fly just over the oceans. So some of them are content to build a handful of planes to start and then expand later.
Anything we should have talked to you about that we've forgotten or omitted, or any concluding comments on your part?
No, thank you. And I didn't even know we would get to talk about the supersonic jets. That may be my favorite story, so I'm excited to learn more about that. So maybe I can come back on the show and talk more about that sometime.
Absolutely. Do you have an article coming out on that in Aerospace America?
No, but I did go to the Smithsonian this weekend, and I saw the Concorde on display, so that got me excited about it again.
Absolutely. I have a great personal interest. I don't know what the audience interest is in the supersonic jet, but I have a terrific interest in it. So I'm absolutely willing to do another show. So when you're ready to do that, and you're the absolute expert on it, and you can really tell us a lot about it, let me know, and we'll absolutely do a full program about it.
Yeah, sure. Anytime there's a story that interests you, please call me, and I'd be glad to chat again.
Yeah, I'm really interested in that. So we definitely need to follow up on that, and Europa as well. So and I hope Bridenstine does a great job. And
I think we'll see.
Well, you know, it'll unfold real time before our eyes, so to speak. Tom, it's been great meeting you, and I want to thank you for being with us for a full space show program. And I will get this archived early in the morning, California time, and send you the location of where it is and all the archive information. And I'll look forward to talking to you again down the road. And I really enjoy your work, and it makes Aerospace America a great magazine. And listeners, if you're not getting it and you're not reading it, you're missing out. That's about all I can say. It really is a great asset to staying involved on cutting-edge information. That's it, listeners. Remember, no Hotel Mars this week. Orbital ATK on Friday, and then we have our Sunday show. And then I'm going to be gone. I have a weird schedule for the following week because of my trip to Los Angeles. So everyone have a great rest of the week, and we certainly thank Tom for being with us tonight, for all of you who emailed and called, and keep looking up. Good night from Tom, David, and The Space Show.